Hello and welcome back to the Chochmat Nashim podcast. I'm Ann Gordon, here today with
Shoshana Keats-Jaskol.
We have a very special guest today. You know her as one of our Chochmat Nashim co-founders, Rachel Stomel.
Hello.
Rachel is back because she is our expert witness, as I like to say, on our topic today, which we will get to shortly. We're going to be talking about the potential conflict, shall we say, between feminism and orthodoxy. We're going to discuss that at length. I mean, not too long. But first, this happened.
This happened is something that unfortunately happens too often. This time it happened to a Holocaust survivor at an exhibition outside City Hall. Her face was graffitied over by, we don't know who, but we can imagine Haredi hooligans, as these are generally people who perpetrate this extremism. It was actually done two or three times and replaced two or three times. And I actually went down to City Hall. I spoke with Deputy Mayor Flor Chasun Nachum. We discussed that it can't just be replaced. The problem needs to be addressed at its beginning. The mayor needs to speak with the people in the coalition to talk to their community. It's not enough to say, well, nobody I know would do this, because someone is doing this over and over and over again. And if we don't speak out against it, well, nothing is sacred. If you can spray paint over the face of a Holocaust survivor, clearly in her 80s or 90s, nothing is sacred, and we have gone way past any red lines. I hope not, but I imagine I'll be here doing another This Happened like this in the near future.
I hope not. We have another This Happened. Unfortunately, it's a different kind of an attempt to erase, in this case, silence women, although not exactly. It's a little more bizarre than that. In the Knesset, in the new Knesset, with the new government, the coalition whip is female. Her name is Idit Silman. She is from the Yamina party, and she is, I don't know, female? Fairly young, but definitely. I think the key part here is that she is female. And so now twice she has been told by various Knesset members that she needs to do whatever she needs to do like a good girl or a little girl. The first time it happened was right when the coalition came in to lead the government, and Chaver Knesset MK Meir Porush, who is from the United Torah Judaism Party, he's in the opposition, he called her a little girl. He wanted the floor, and she was making him wait his turn, as one does in the Knesset, because lots of people have something to say in the Knesset. And, you know, he rebuked her for not allowing him to speak out of turn, which is just so mind-boggling to begin with that this would happen. But there is this thing of like, I am a graybeard rabbi and you are, quote, a little girl. She said at that time, don't call me a little girl, I'm not a little girl. You know, and she said to him, you will have your turn to speak like everybody else in order. This week, Miki Zohar, who is the Likud faction chair, he's the faction chair of the Likud, he came in late. He wanted to know what he had missed. And when she told him, you know, to ask the people sitting next to him, like, catch up with your neighbor, don't interrupt everything going on, he said to her, who are you anyway? Answer like a good girl, which is perhaps even more demeaning than the little girl comment. And she answered back, thank God, she's got a strong backbone here. I won't answer you like a good girl. You came late. You disrupt the committee. You should be ashamed, Miki Zohar. And yes, this is news. It's ridiculous that it's news. But she is the coalition whip, meaning she's the director of ceremonies, so to speak, meaning she is running the plenum of the, I don't know if I'm using all these words correctly, because I know there's a lot of technical terms in government and I don't want to get them wrong, but the bottom line is she's directing traffic and
she's in charge and they are not, and they are not used to her being in charge and then not being in charge. So you've got this like loss of power, this privilege, and this like, wait a minute, things should stop when I walk in the room, plus a little good old misogyny all mixed in there. And it's like, bow. And I have to be honest with you, she was so composed. I mean, those videos were going around and I was just like,
oh, like,
this is how you handle it.
She's clearly doing a very fine job of being in charge. Okay, let's get to our topic. Shoshana, what we know, and Rachel, this is also why you're here. What we know is that there was a very large Facebook group that addressed a lot of the issues that we touch on in Chochmat Nashim, and it was recently closed. Shoshana, can you give us the lowdown?
So unfortunately, it kind of like passed me by. It kind of happened. I was like, wait, what? Like I opened up the group and it was like archived. I'm like, archived? Like I thought I had the wrong group. There's a really powerful, or I don't know if it's powerful, but it's meaningful to a lot of us. I'm a religious feminist and I also have no sense of humor. It's a Hebrew group. Which is a play on the idea that feminists don't have senses of humor.
Which
and
is supposed
it really,
to be funny, except for
it's supposed to be funny, exactly.
Also, sometimes it's true.
Right. Well, it's hard to have a sense of humor about some things that are not funny.
Or maybe that's the point.
So this group is a place where I think a lot of us, there are 18,000 members, okay? And a lot of us felt we had a home where we could discuss that tension between orthodoxy, you know, Judaism, and the desire to have your opportunities and your voice. Unfortunately, in orthodoxy, we often don't have that. So it was a really special place, I think, that gave people a lot of voice and a lot of support. I actually opened it up to post something, I think, and saw that it was gone. And it actually, even though I wasn't a big poster there, you know, Hebrew is a distant second language for me, so it's not my easiest go-to, but I felt like I missed something, and I felt like something was missing from my life. And
so why did they close it?
So the post actually was, I took the time to read it. It's super long. It's really a painful, I guess, discussion of the woman who opened it. She said, this is why I'm closing it. And what's fascinating is she opened it, and then she came, almost like she went through this journey. She came to a conclusion that it's impossible to bring them together. And some of the phrases that she uses and some of the way that she speaks, like, I don't need permission to exist. You don't need permission to, your body is beautiful. You're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. No more asking questions. And she almost, you could feel, not almost, you could feel her closing this chapter and saying, I've made my decision. I've come out the other side and I've decided this is impossible.
Wait, so can you take us a step back and just fill us in on what exactly, why she came to close it? I understand she wrote a long treatise about why, but
yeah,
why?
So, I mean, look, I'll read just a little bit of it in English. She says, a relationship that builds you as secondary is a constant alienation of your existence and your space, makes you always doubt, makes you ask if you're allowed to be there, if your body, your sexuality, a relationship that insults and entrenches these insults into the way the system works. It just can't, basically she described it as an abusive relationship. I mean, that was the bottom line. She said, I can't be in this space anymore. You know, we live a lot with tension and she couldn't be in the space anymore and she had to make a decision. And she felt that the way the system is now, it's not compatible with her wanting to be a full person and she closed it.
Feminism won.
Feminism one. Rachel, I see your face. Okay, so you can respond. That's fine.
So I think I interpret that a bit differently when she had her goodbye post. A phrase that she used a lot was the phrase masach ashan, which means a smokescreen. And her big, you know, claim was that not necessarily that you can't reconcile per se feminism and you know, religion or orthodoxy or whatever, but more that the changes that people are trying to make ultimately keep ending up, and instead including this group, ultimately ends up being a smokescreen for the problems, that we're taking the problems and, you know, like laundering them and kind of whitewashing them and giving them better names and giving them a more, you know, feminist terminology. But in the end of the day, the inherent problems are still there. And by having a group of lichora, whatever how you would say that in English, of having these quote unquote,
apparently,
you know, feminist faces and names covering up the problems, so that it does more damage than not.
You mean by like apologetics, that kind of stuff? Is that what you're talking
not
about?
Not mostly apologetics, but I'll give you an example. She didn't bring this up. Just an example, you know, that I've seen a lot from you know, my life, that the, for example, the inherent problems in Jewish marriage, that there's inequality there. And that also, you know, it's expressed in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways is that the actual marriage ceremony, you know, the women just stand there silently and, you know, things are, you know, she's acted upon rather than being an active participant, which is, you know, that's just how the chuppah ceremony is. And so some people try to introduce all sorts of things like a woman can, you know, say a shechianu, which is what I did at my wedding. You can have people who, you know, women say various things, or they have, you know, women reading the ketubah, or they try to do things to have women be part of the ceremony. Some people also, you know, like Rabbi Dov Linzer has an article about how you can have, you know, the couple exchange rings without that canceling out the kinyan, and all sorts of different things that people try to introduce, you know, changes to make it feel more in tune with their feminist or, you know, humanistic ideology.
Some of which is not accepted by other officiating rabbis.
Right, I mean,
a lot of people would
Judaism,
not accept a two-ring
ceremony. A lot of things are not accepted by other people because that's how we do things. But basically, these people trying to make these changes on a, you know, more surface level. And some people say that that obfuscates the problem because you know, we are making it feel more okay. We're making it feel more feminist. And by doing so, we're actually hiding the problem that this structurally is unequal. You know, phrases, for example, like putting lipstick on a pig, you know, taking something that is really problematic, making it feel better. And then because it feels better, we don't address the inherent problems. So what Devorah was saying in this post was that she feels, you know, there's so many things in religious feminism that are like that, that are these, you know, cosmetic changes that are more on the surface level. And so that the group itself, you know, she called it a smokescreen. It's one of these things. And because of the group existing and because of us putting a more, you know, easier to digest face on a really hard to digest problem, we are actually regressing and not progressing. So that was her big claim here.
So I think actually what you've just said and what Shoshana, what you said before is actually totally in concert, meaning you're elaborating on why she thinks they're not compatible, but it's not that they're not compatible. She totally thinks they're not compatible.
I think you think more like the methodology of how we're going to make it work was not this. She didn't necessarily say what it was, but she, you know, she could say what it wasn't. And she felt like the group was what it wasn't.
Rather than dissect her post and her feelings, because she's one person at the end of the day, we, you know, all of us obviously have dealt with this before in different ways. And I think it's really interesting to hear how we feel about, are they incompatible? And I actually asked this on all of our social media last night just to get a sense. And a lot of the women and even men want to say, no, feminism and orthodoxy are not incompatible. We just have to A, define them well, and B, work with them together and recognize that feminism is not necessarily exactly what orthodoxy is going to be, but it can work together. Well, and the desire to make it work, I think, is fantastic. Like, we need that. At the same time, we really need to acknowledge that sometimes they are just completely clashing. So I would love to hear from you guys before I talk. How do you feel about this? You know, like, we're all religious. We're obviously here, whether we define ourselves as feminists or not. Where are we on this?
Yes, I think, you know, when you said, Shoshana, that sometimes it just doesn't work, I think that we need to be less scared of that. I think that, you know, as people who are feminists and people who are religious, it would be really great if we can say everything I believe in is always in concert with each other. And that's not how it works. Problem lies in, you know, when we see things in Judaism, you know, as it is interpreted by Orthodox practice, and we say, like, this is problematic, and maybe this is even bad. The reason why that's a problem is because if you want to continue defining yourself as a religious person, which you have to do in order to stay part of the discourse, if you, you know, say that I think this thing is bad, no one's going to listen to you. You know, no one's going to, you have to, you know, kind of couch it in these other kind of terms, like, oh, this isn't per se a bad thing, just it's harmful because there are bad actors who have hijacked it and turned it into a bad thing, or the way that we interpret it, you know, causes harm, or, you know, there's the bad rabbis or the bad leadership or the bad people who are saying things in Judaism's name, but it's really not real Judaism, you know, quote unquote, unquote, unquote.
I'm going to take issue with you. It's a pleasure to have you back, Rachel. I'm going to take issue with you. Because I think that is true. There are bad actors. There are people who messed with the way things are supposed to be.
Yeah, there definitely are. But we have to also remember that there are certain things that are just bad, you know, that are hard, that it's not always just someone misinterpreting or someone hijacking. There are plenty of those people, as there are in every sort of structure or religion or anything you go to. There will be people who are taking things that are amazing and using it to hurt people, because people are awful.
Are bad.
But even when people are really good and people have the best of intentions, and, you know, people say, oh, just the rabbis don't care. No, sometimes the rabbis do care. And sometimes there are really good people and there are legitimate problems that they are trying to solve and they cannot. Or, you know, people, not just, you know, anyone who is trying to work on something, or they see something that is harmful and that is problematic. And we can't call the things that are problematic bad. We can't say this is wrong. Because if you say something in religion is wrong, you will be branded as not religious, as a heretic, or whatever. And then your ability to make any sort of change or any sort of contribution is automatically curtailed, because no one listens to you. Why should listen to you? You're not even religious.
But that's a pragmatic concern. I think people are wary of calling things bad in religion. Let's say nobody wants to say the halacha is bad or the halacha is wrong because they don't want to think that there's something wrong with halacha. Now, there's another piece to this, which is I think there are people who truly don't think that the halacha is wrong. So that the fact that we have a clash of opinions about a given halacha, right? So there are rabbis who would say, sure, this is a challenge. Let's say the phenomenon of the imbalance of divorce. And so for someone feminist coming to this, somebody who wants an equal, balanced situation of marriage is going to find this to be problematic and maybe just needs to dare a little bit more to say wrong. But I think that you will have sincere, caring rabbis who will say, it's not wrong. This is the Torah. And we need to square our emotions and our modern sensibilities with the halacha that is given to us. Meaning it's a different kind of approach. It's not just not being daring enough. It's a completely different orientation to the same exact scenario.
I'm not saying like necessarily that it's not being daring enough. I mean that it's a choice that is weighed and that is made out of very, you know, practical concerns, which clashes a bit with, you know, the feminist idea of it's really important to call out something, to name something, to say this is what it is, and this is why it's bad. And a lot of times, because people who identify as religious feminists are kind of walking that very careful line in between, you know, religion and feminism and how to square these away. And the communities that also come with, you know, the religious community and the feminist community are also, you know, it's not just that feminism and religion are ideologies, it's also the whole, you know, all the people that come with it, which is a whole other thing. But if you want to remain in both of those camps, then you have to often word things in ways that dance around the idea instead of actually calling things for what they are. And, you know, that's a choice that a lot of people make because that's what they do. And I think what happens in the end of the day is you end up, you know, working a lot to prove that you're actually okay, that you're actually religious, that you're actually whatever, that you're not really compromising on your values in either direction. And because you have to always kind of come from this defensive spot and apologizing all the time and saying, well, actually it's good. This is just bad, but we're minimizing how bad it is so that we can change it, which is often counterproductive. And then you get to a point where, you know, you have this group that collapses on itself because they spend it's so hard to at the same time prop up something and defend something that you're trying to call out. And there's this tension that you're always like, you know, and I think that we could really alleviate a lot of that tension if we weren't so fragile. Like if we didn't think that if someone says that, hey, I see this thing and it is wrong, or I see this thing and it is bad, this is hurting someone and it's a negative thing. And you don't have to couch it in terms of, but it's also whatever, and I still believe this, and I'm still a good girl because we have to maybe stop doing that and
but
be
no,
able
but so
to.
I think what you're saying is perfect. Meaning, I think that the acknowledging where people are at and where people are suffering and where that is in fact problematic means, like, let's be human about this and let's recognize all this. And the question about the halachic system, either A, you can table it, or B, you can still uphold it and acknowledge that this is the result. This pain is the result of that. What you do with the system, what you do with your own sensibilities about what theology and philosophy and how you're going to handle a belief in halacha and Torah and what you do, it can be a whole separate arena. I was telling Shoshana when we were talking about this beforehand, when we were choosing a topic, I said, you know, some of these issues that are so burning for some people are not at all burning for other people, and not only because of different approaches in ideology, which is obviously going to change what is burning for you and what's not, but also because I find, and I'm sure you both can relate to this, like at different stages of life, different things are more okay, less okay, and for that matter, sometimes they're just not even on the radar. And then people can get really upset with you. Like, why aren't you upset by this thing that should be upsetting you? Because clearly it's the most important, terrible thing right now, which for that person it is. And for the next person over, it's not terrible because it's not terrible. And for the next person over, it's not terrible because they're not thinking about it right now because they're too occupied with something else. I think that after a year of this crazy pandemic, the idea that people are kind of have different focuses at all kinds of times is maybe more obvious than it has been, right? Because some people were stuck at home and that was their issue. And some people were dealing with life and death situations, and that was their issue. It was just a really different reality that affected literally everybody.
I think it also depends. Like, I'm not a singer. I have no need to get on stage. I don't have to worry about Kol Isha. Like, mamash, not an issue for me at all. And yet there are women for whom it is a devastating and life-altering problem that they can't sing. That is who they are. That's what they do. And they're being kept from their dreams and their passions. And I can't blame them for feeling the way that they feel about it, even if I'm not out there trying to change Kol Isha. So it's not my issue. So I'm able easily to sidestep that problem specifically as an example, I think, Anne, of what you're saying, where you are in life, what you need, where your tension is. Also, I think that it depends on what you're up against, even in terms of which community you're in and where you live and what you're able to do. Sometimes there's communal rules that aren't even halachic rules that you are coming up against. And there are women who can't drive in Stamford Hill, for God's sake. So there's like a lot of different areas where for some of this is not relevant for us. And some of it is systemic and some is individual. And there's a big difference. And if you as an individual are incapable of holding that tension because it affects who you are to such a degree, then I can understand walking away, because that burden isn't for your passion. It's not for a Shabbos conversation. It's not for an essay or even a PhD. That is who you are. And so it really depends on where you're at. And for me, someone who really, I love Judaism. I love being an Orthodox person. And I've said this before. For me, it's 95% fab and 5% we have got to talk about this. So for me, when I look at Judaism and Orthodoxy and Torah itself, the meta halacha or the overall essence of Judaism is love, kindness, giving, go figure the rest out. Okay? I know, I think, I mean, it's okay, I understand. You can't see Rachel's faces, which is a real shame, because it's worth it. But I think overall, God wants you to be a good person, okay? And everything else is commentary. We can agree on that at least. Now, when it boils down, you know, do we still, you know, sell our daughters if we have no money? We do not. Do we still have women marry their rapists? We do not. You know, not that they have to, but I understand it's because this way hopefully people won't rape, blah, 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 I get it. Point being, some of these things in the Torah are just there because human nature was such at that time when the Torah was given that these things mattered. We do not do them, not because God was wrong, but because it's irrelevant right now. They're just not relevant.
But some people might call that heresy, to say it's not relevant, you know? Like, well, there's a bunch of things in the Torah that we find, you know, we say that it's there just that we can learn about it. You know, we still have to make it relevant in some way, you know, that we're getting the, you know, the reward of learning it because it's Torah, but we're not actually going to implement. For example, you know, a Ben Soramora, you know, the rebellious child that you're supposed to take out. And they said it never actually happened. So they say, why is it there in the Torah if it never happened? Because this is something that, like, you know, any person reads about and they're like, wow, this is barbaric and I reject this. But we can't say I reject this because of, you know, we can't do that. So we say that it's still part of our consciousness in some way because we're going to learn about it and get reward, because, you know, we can't.
Or a lesson or a morality or something like that. Yeah.
The Rambam, and I understand we are not the Rambam and we don't have his shoulders, but he had no problem saying that the Ketoret in the Beit HaMikdash was for defumigation, to say that the entirety of Karbanot, right, animal sacrifice, was to satisfy a need of people who were had been surrounded and steeped in a culture of idolatry in Egypt. Meaning,
that's criticizing
again,
the people, though. It's not criticizing, you know, saying that God put this there and wow, that's harsh.
No, it's,
you know, like, we don't say.
No, it. Rachel is not criticizing the people. It's not criticizing anything. It's saying that here there was a need. It was a temporal need. And so the Torah, given at a specific time, addressed particularly this. I mean, I hear everything you're saying. I'm just saying that I think that it's complicated when we're going to talk about what is the tension here. And I would like to actually bring it back to that question, which is, how do we live with the tension? And I don't think that we're going to answer it today. I just want to raise it. Like, for some, I think, Shoshana, you said this, right? For some people, living with that tension is manageable. And for some people, depending on what the issue is and depending who you are as an individual, you know, at some point it explodes and you can't. I think that living with tension is what we do all the time. About other things, not just the role of Torah in our lives and also our existence as women in the world. And also, I would say this is true, meaning the fact that there are contradictory things in the world is true. I don't mean just that they exist. I mean that they are inherently contradictory and yet important, valuable, meaningful, whatever. So the fact that, yes, I think that it is certainly for those of us who identify as modern Orthodox, Datilumi, something like that, where we know that we're at an intersection of worlds, I buy in to the idea that we are going to live with tension. And some things are going to bother me and some things are going to bother me less.
And I would say for anyone who's listening who feels like, okay, but I'm being told that orthodoxy is right, or Judaism is right, and feminism is 100% wrong, because two systems can't be right together and work together, meaning it's all or nothing. And I want to say to those people, I'm sorry, but you're being misled. It's not all or nothing. This is all about Judaism. And I think it was you who said this when we were having this conversation. We ask questions all the time. We argue all the time. We figure things out all the time. And, you know, the Gemara is full of conversations about what the hell are we supposed to do here? Okay, they don't say it like that, but sometimes they do. But the point is that it's not all or nothing. And making a system all or nothing, by the way, is a great way to lose everything. That's why you see people who go off the derech, quote unquote. And a lot of times it's because one thing that they thought was, you know, the MS and it has to be this way was proven to them. Wow. Or all rabbis aren't great, or all this truth doesn't hold up to the sunshine. And then you lose everything. And I don't think that that's where we want to be. I know that that's where I don't want to be.
And so I would say that I would think in the era currently, I think that the world is more polarized, and yet there were things that were just obvious that nobody would ever engage in them or whatever back in the day, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. Some of these, like, for example, the Kol Isha questions or the marriage questions, that people are now coming to a different platform, using what they can, making compromises, that somebody else would come and point fingers and say, you're not doing this right, you're a heretic, you don't really keep the Torah, right? We've seen plenty of people do that kind of finger pointing. And yet at the end of the day, that's between them and God, right? It's not for me to judge whether somebody who manages her Kol Isha desire and skill by actually singing, right? Like, people will do what they need to do. And I think that the world is big enough and the Torah is strong enough to tough it out.
And I think that we as a people, you know, we are called Am Yisrael. Like, the word Yisrael literally means people who struggle with God. You know, like, feminists didn't invent this, you know, like, since before we have been a people. And, you know, this is why we became a people, is because of this struggle with God. So, you know, the most traditional thing we can do is to dabble in heresy, you might even say. So, hey.
Thanks, Rachel.
On that note, Rachel, thank you for the, actually, it's a nice Dvar Torah about Am Yisrael. We are going to close this discussion. It is never closed. We will continue it in all the places that we talk to you and talk amongst ourselves, and we invite you to come talk to us as well. Before we go today, we have our dish component of the episode.
Mine is really, really simple. It's a Speyside single malt scotch. It's pretty much what helps me get through the tensions that we talked about all day. So that's my suggestion.
Okay, I've got a piece of news, which is also, I think, worthy of a dish. Namely, Matan, the Women's Institute of Learning. The flagship institute is in Jerusalem. There are satellites in, I don't want to name them all because I'm going to forget them, but I know there's at least in Beit Shemesh, Chashmonaim, Ranana, Be'er Sheva. I'm sure there's some others. Is changing leadership. Rabbanit Malkabina, who founded Matan and thereby really truly contributed to a massive change in the face of women's Torah education, is, I don't want to say she's stepping down, because she's kind of stepping up. She's going to become the president of the organization, the institution, and Dr. Yael Ziegler is going to take over as Rosh Batei Midrashot, and Chaya Bina Katz, that's Rabbanit Malka Bina's daughter, is going to take over as CEO, and the pair of them are now going to run the institution. I don't know exactly what date this goes into effect, but they have made quite a public announcement, and it's kind of a changing of the guard, changing of the era with, you know, I would say every woman who learns can thank Malka Bina for everything that Matan has done in the world of Torah education for women. And I know both Chaya Bina Katz and Dr. Yael Ziegler personally. I wish them both well. And they are both very, very, very well chosen for these roles. I'm excited to see what they bring to the fore.
We really do want to hear what you think. I think this is one of the topics that, as Anne said, is an endless conversation point. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, CHOCHMAT.
NASHIM.
Thank you. Can you hear us now?